I confuse people. It's my special power, and I don't mean to do it, but I do. I'm confessing this to you tonight. I confuse all kinds of people, but the people I confuse most of all are the ones who work in HR, recruitment, or executive search. These people, they're sitting at their desks, happily minding their own business, putting everything they see into neat little boxes, and then they meet me, and they have some kind of fit, and they have to go and lie down for a while. And then after that, they usually direct my emails to spam, and I'll never hear from them again. Why is this? Why do I have this effect on these people? Well, you can give me your suggestions at the end, but I think it's because I just don't fit. I don't fit into the little boxes so beloved of HR people, recruiters, and executive search professionals. And I don't fit because I sort of refuse to do just one thing. This started young with me. As a teenager, I loved writing programs for my BBC Micro, which shows my age, and wandering through graveyards, smoking cigarettes and writing poetry. I didn't see any kind of disjunction between those activities. And as a student, I was similar. I studied neurophysiology and design experiments and read Wittgenstein and had my own band and took a play to the Edinburgh Festival. You could argue, and people have done, that I did too many things and I didn't do any of them very well. And you might well be right. In the play, won Turkey of the Year Award in Edinburgh, so you know, wasn't my finest hour. But I wanted to be a writer, and you know, that's eventually what I became. And that meant, as far as I could see, understanding how lots of different human activities fit together to make a whole society. So it made sense to me to dig my hands into as many of these activities as I could. When the World Wide Web arrived in my early 20s, suddenly this breadth made perfect sense. The web was science and art combined. Technical form and expressive content became inseparable. To quote Marshall McLuhan, the patron saint of the internet, the medium was the message, in a manner that had never been so completely true before. I became a technology journalist, evangelizing this new realm, and at the same time I became a novelist, writing novels inspired, as I've explained, by the changes happening in science and technology around me. And to me and my peers, some of whom are here, I'm pleased to say, this combination seemed the most natural thing in the world, and we were the future, and the future was now. But then the dot-com bubble burst, and things got reconfigured. The creative explosion that had been the web in the 90s got tamed and funneled into a handful of major gateways: Google, Facebook, Amazon, eBay, Twitter, LinkedIn. And that set a trend that continued through the 2008 recession and the economic stagnation that's beset the global economy ever since, right into this new growth phase that I think we're about to begin, the sort of so-called Internet of Things. As McLuhan predicted, what has value now is not the content, is not the message, but the means of organizing and transmitting it, the medium itself. When you summon a car from your phone to take you to the airport, you don't care anymore if it's a Seat or a Volvo or a Merc. Because what matters to you, what you pay for, is the fact that it's an Uber. That's all that really counts. And thus, science has pushed back on art since the dot-com crash. The geek inherited the earth and sought revenge for generations of oppression by subjecting the quality of content to the law of large numbers and rendering it all but irrelevant. What, something I feel very painful and personal about. What matters now is not the engineering efficacy of the delivery mechanism. Sorry, what matters now is the engineering efficacy of the delivery mechanism and the scale of that flow, not the detail of that which flows. Sensitive to this change, which was a pretty inevitable consequence of a system scaling up by an order of magnitude from hundreds of millions of users to billions of users, which is really what has been going on, I changed too. I left a newspaper industry that was proving itself increasingly incapable of adapting to this new environment, extended various engineering stubs in my educational background, a handy legacy of trying all those different things when I was younger, and dived into the world of startups. All that time, however, I was still writing fiction, working, in fact, on the book that I've read from this evening. And now it's written, I'm even publishing it in startup style, through the crowdfunding publisher Unbound, and yes, I do want you to pledge for it. There are flyers on the table. Please take one home and sign up afterwards, because otherwise it will never be published. But when I'm out promoting my book or writing its blog, which is part of the promotion, I suppose, I don't really talk about my tech experience, largely because I've always been told by agents and publishers and those in the industry that it's not really relevant. And when I'm job hunting or talking to investors, I don't mention my fiction. Again, largely because I'm continually advised by those pesky recruiters and so on that it will be a distraction and it will put people off. But why? Why should it put people off in either direction? Why should novel writing and running a business be seen as antithetical? My thesis, the thesis I'm going to put to you tonight, is that they have more in common than people realize. That experience of one, in fact, informs, helps, and supports experience of the other. And that the habitual denial of this comes down to the simple fact that the triumph of engineering has codified the job market to the point where if you don't fit into a box that's been pre-labeled by an abstracted algorithmic process, you cannot get either funding or employment. A job market that, despite calls for evidence of creativity and leadership on every single job description, in reality wants nothing of the sort, and wants instead to make Uber drivers of us all. But enough of that. As I say, this is a positive postulation, not a negative rant. A thesis, not a critique. So, I put to you the proposal that books and businesses are very alike, and as evidence for this, I present Exhibit A, the business plan. Now, if I had a PowerPoint, this is the point which the PowerPoint would happen. I'm guessing that most of you are familiar with this form. The company abstracts, the product descriptions, the unique selling points, team profiles, total addressable market, target market, 6-year financial projections, growth curves, competitive analysis. It's all powerful stuff. But as Field Marshal Helmut von Moltke famously said, no plan survives first contact with the enemy. And this is as true for the business plan as for the military strategy. Key team members leave, or in the case of the military, are killed. Legislation and trade agreements change. Competitors prove to be more nimble in anticipating and outflanking you than you anticipated. Legal fees mushroom out of control as you're hit with a patent infringement suit. Your CFO is found lining his pockets with company funds. Customers spurn your flagship product, but flock in great numbers to the thing you built as an afterthought, or they just don't flock at all. Random shit happens. And if you put all those possibilities in your business plan, it would be unreadable. Not to mention longer than War and Peace. And no one wants this. Your investors don't want it. Your employees don't want it. Your advisors don't want it. None of them have time to read it, apart from anything else. What they want most of all from your business plan is a great story. A story that excites them. A story they can believe in. A story that, above all, they can retell to others when they have to justify why the hell they invested in you or allow themselves to be hired by you. So what is your business plan, really, but one gigantic fiction? A story that will be responsible for convincing people to put their money and or their careers on the line. And what this story tests, what it provides proof of, is not whether your target market is the size that you say it is or if you're going to hit cash flow break even at the end of year three. Everyone knows this is all highly unlikely. What it tests is whether or not you can sell. Because the business plan is a sales pitch. Can you sell your business to investors and partners and employees? Can you sell a story good enough to hook them in? If you can, if you get them to commit their cash and resources, then even if they know nothing else about you and don't believe a single curve or infographic in whatever document you've dropped on their heads, they now know this. They know that you can sell because you've just sold them on your plan. And that means that whatever else happens, and as we've already established, random shit will, you've got more than a snowball's chance in Silicon Valley of selling something to the one person that really matters, which is the customer. And it's the same with writing a book. Obviously, a novel is all about telling a story. That goes without saying. But stories have to be sold before they can be written. And the first person the writer needs to sell the story to, both investor, employee, and employer, is yourself. You have to come up with an idea for which you think it's worth sacrificing years and years of other opportunities, of parties and TV watching and quality time with your children, perhaps even your entire career. And you need to understand too, as CEO of the project, that what you've sold yourself is just a fiction, a shadow of a story, a plan that must change as reality strikes. Because the book will change as you write it. The story you start with is not the story with which you'll end up. Stories are dynamic. Your characters evolve as you write them. As they grow, so do you. As a result, they will behave in ways that you cannot anticipate when you begin. And it's absolutely crucial to fiction that you allow this process to happen. If you don't, the story will feel mechanical. Characters and dialogue will feel dead on the page, and the reader will not feel involved in the world of your novel, which means they'll be unconvinced, bored, and won't suspend disbelief. In other words, they won't buy it. So in its actual writing, writing a novel is like running a business. You have a plan, a great story, but it's just that. In the execution of that plan, things will change. The plan has to be flexible enough to allow that. My first novel, Habitus, was written over 7 years. I didn't mean for it to take that long, but it did. A lot changed in that time. I was in my 20s. My third novel, The Book of Ash, took 10 years. If you include the 3 years I had to take out in the middle of it to write my second novel, 52 Ways to Magic America. And if you include the entire completed version of the book I had to throw away before I worked out how to get it right. My fourth novel, Midland, this one, has taken another 10 years. During that time, I got married. My lovely wife sitting down here. Thank you very much for coming, Robin. Still patiently listening to me. Look at that. It's devotion. I made her come. I paid to come. Got married. Renovated a house. Had two children. Seen my father pass away. I'm not the same person I was when I started that book. I've changed, the book has changed, the book has changed me as I've written it. Just as an entrepreneur who builds a successful business or a failing one is changed by that experience and all it involves. But because I've got better at these things, while my first three books had dozens of plans, plans after plans after plans, Midland had just one plan. And it was sketched out on a single side of A4 paper and it stayed pretty much the same exactly through the entire decade. This journey of personal growth, of self-discovery is a big part of the reason that we do things. It's basic empiricism. We experiment and put ourselves in crisis in order to learn, to find out about how the world works and what we're really made of. Those discoveries will change us, and maybe we discover something really big or really resonant or really influential that'll change the world a little bit as well and make a dent in the universe, as Steve Jobs famously said. I wrote the Book of Ash to find out what I thought about the nuclear industry in the hope that I could develop some kind of firm opinion about nuclear power. I'm not actually sure I succeeded in that, although I'm quite happy with the book that I ended up with. I wrote Midland to discover what I thought about my father dying as I became a father myself, in the hope that I could make some kind of map of the challenges of midlife that would help me better tackle those challenges and perhaps help others tackle them too. Along the way, of course, I hope to make a living, and in that way, writing a novel isn't just like a business, it is a business. There is a target market, a real one, different for sci-fi and chick lit and literary fiction and historical. Your characters are products, products of the times you're writing in, and the time the book's set, but also part of the book's packaging, part of its marketing, part of its sell. They have to feel real and true to their milieu, but also have to appeal to the customer, the reader, who lives very much in the now. Your competitors are not only other novelists, but also films and Facebook and families, all the other calls that your potential reader has on their very valuable and limited time. You've got to give them a damn good reason to ignore all those things and settle down to spend 20 hours or so with you. So once you've pitched the book to yourself and gone and written it, you've now got to pitch the result of all that effort to the reader. And it better be a damn good pitch as well, else you're not going to get very far and your ROI will be nil. This is perhaps the biggest challenge in running, in writing, or in running a business. You can't be one person. You have to be two. You have to be both a producer, the executive, the creator, and in almost the same breath be the salesperson, the marketeer, the evangelist. Even if the first bit is going horribly wrong, the second bit always has to be confident, breezy, solid as hell. This is very hard for writers, most of whom are natural introverts. I mean, I know I am. And For entrepreneurs, the challenge is reversed. Natural extroverts, they are. Selling's the easy bit for them. Settling down and maintaining the focus to deliver what they've promised, that's what they find really difficult. It's why so many entrepreneurs get sacked by their own boards once the business is a going concern. And it's why writers were traditionally locked in back rooms by film studios. Thanks largely to the communications revolution, you can no longer expect to survive for very long on one half of this equation. Entrepreneurs and CEOs are under the spotlight like never before, constantly having to reinvent themselves and their companies as leaner, fleeter outfits snap at their heels. While writers are expected to market themselves like never before, there is just so much content out there now. Publishers won't even pull you off their slush pile if your manuscript isn't accompanied with 20,000 followers or Twitter or your own YouTube channel. And why should they? Their own business plans have been put into crisis by contact with the internet, just like everyone else's. And they can no longer afford to take anything that feels like a risk. Your story is the story that sells them on your book. The book story on its own is sadly no longer enough. That's why I find it so mystifying when I'm looking for work or pitching my business that recruiters and investors don't want to hear about the fact that I'm a writer. Because the business of writing is in fact a fantastic training in all the skills needed, both sales and execution, for managing a business at any level. Books are about people, businesses are about people, and the two halves, to my mind at least, make a whole that is very complete. Having said all that, of course, as we all know, the chance of finding success with either book or business is incredibly slim. You have to be crazy to even try and do either. Crazier still to do both. And maybe that's the real reason I don't get along with HR people, recruiters, and executive search pros. They do have a box for me, after all. Unfortunately, it's the box labeled mad. Thanks very much.